Hello and welcome to the Isle of Man podcast, which is where we talk up the Isle of Man, all the things we love about it, while acknowledging that perhaps there are some things that need to be improved. And that's something that our guest today is very, very experienced in. And actually, you couldn't have a podcast about the Isle of Man without speaking to Charles Gard. As you'll hear, it's quite hard to define what Charles is. He's obviously a writer, he's a film producer, but also...
You could call me a local historian. Though when I was doing a little film with a French film crew a couple of years ago, they were over doing features on the Isle of Man and they got me to speak. At the end, the producer said to me, "How would we describe you?" I said, "Oh, well, people usually refer to me as a local historian." He said, "Oh, and have you got a history degree?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, we can't possibly refer to you as an historian. We're very strict about this on French television." So I said, "Look, mate, I'm never going to see it. You can call me what you like." Anyway, former news editor at Manx Radio. That probably gives me some insight, because if we're talking about, and I quite like to talk about, the development of the Isle of Man over the last 40, 50 years, I have witnessed quite a bit of it.
Let's start, though. When I say the words Isle of Man to you, what does that conjure up?
Well, it conjures up my home. I was born here. I'm 74, so I was born in 1951 in a little boarding house on the Prom. I've had really first-hand experience of what was our greatest industry for many years, tourist industry. But it also conjures up a glorious little piece of land in the middle of the Irish Sea with fabulous history, wonderful natural resources, and my home.
What makes the Isle of Man, then, would you say? Is it its heritage, its culture, or its people?
Well, I think it's all of those things. Its natural beauty and its political history is unique and very important. And it's a combination of all those things. But I suppose I'm biased. I think anyone who's born here has a strong affection. I did spend 4 years at the Royal College of Music, 4 years living in Ireland, which I loved very, very much. But the pull for the Isle of Man just overtook me. I know there are people who are born here who go away to work. Maybe I could have gone into journalism in London or somewhere else, but I just couldn't live anywhere else. I had to come back here.
And it's interesting thinking about the industry that you went into with regards to journalism, because typically that's not always about seeking out the most positive stories, I think it's fair to say. And I just wonder how you balance that love of a place with a need to potentially sometimes expose things that aren't so great.
This is a very important point you've raised. I think all journalists, well, we know we have to capture the public's interest. And there was a newsreader, was it Nicholas Witchell or somebody on the BBC, wanted to just do positive news stories. Well, it just doesn't work in terms of numbers. And numbers mean money, numbers mean your success, your rating. If you've got scandal, if you've got things that are going wrong, that unfortunately is what people want to hear. And we know that from the social media. The clicks on that sort of stuff are enormous compared to nice, soft news stories. This is human nature, and I'm afraid we have to pander to that to some extent. But obviously, a journalist's job is to uncover injustices and to report to the people the things that do perhaps need attention.
And over your time then, what are those things that really stand out to you as being the things that you remember covering the most?
Well, I was the news editor here for some years. I also presented the island's first live current affairs programme every morning, Mandate, with my great friend and colleague David Collister. And I at least sat through 70 sittings of Tynwald, which is a lot more than even some current members have sat through. And we saw unfolding all sorts of crises on the island. But now I look back into the 80s, and I'd like to come on to this in a moment. There were some incredibly good decisions that were made by far-sighted politicians and civil servants. The calibre of people in those days was exceptional. The debate in Tynwald, when you saw people like Jack Nivison or Clifford Irving or Charlie Caruish stand up to speak, you sat back because you were going to be entertained with great oratory. And if they were getting at someone, they did it forensically. You couldn't withstand what they were saying. But it wasn't vicious or nasty. It was beautifully presented. They were really great politicians. And you look at some of the decisions they made. They set the foundations for what the Isle of Man is today. And most people have forgotten all that or don't even know about it. And it's really worth just remembering that.
And I think that's the root of this podcast, Charles. It's talking about why perhaps people who are living on the Isle of Man, who were perhaps born and bred here on the Isle of Man, maybe don't realise what we've got, and we don't talk ourselves up enough, not compared to some other places around the world. I don't know, is there not that sort of sense of pride anymore, and has that been diminished because of the likes of social media and the negative clickbait?
It probably has, but it's also that we take so much for granted. We are unfortunately somewhat entitled. We do feel that if there are no avocados, then, you know, why aren't there any avocados? Well, excuse me, when I was a boy, we'd never even heard of an avocado. If I look how far we've come, and anyone of my age can say this anywhere in the British Isles, it is just extraordinary. If I could just go back and give you the timeline, in the 50s, we still had the tourist industry that was still almost at its peak. I remember everything was still running. There was a Punch and Judy show. There were donkeys on the beach. Russian Abbey and all the other places were still running. White City, the fabulous Palace Coliseum Theatre, which is where the Palace Hotel now is, sat 2,000 people, and every year, every summer, they had the most fabulous variety show, the dancing in the ballroom afterwards, the coach tours, everything was still running. And we thought, that's never going to stop. But of course it did, because people are always inventing things. They invented the aircraft, the jets, the flights to Spain, and all that gradually opened up. And our tourist industry declined, not through any fault of our own, but because people wanted to go abroad. And there was nothing we could do about it. We tried, the tourist board, all the rest of it. But by the time we got to the 70s and the early 80s, our tourist industry was in a desperate state. I remember reporting the auction of a boarding house on Loch Prom in the 80s. You could buy one for £12,000 because the government refused to let the owners change them into holiday accommodation or self-catering because they said they're tourist hotels. But sorry, there is no tourist industry. But then something had happened in the 60s, and this is the story of the Isle of Man. As one door closes, another one opens, and you don't notice it at first. But if you go through it, you go to somewhere else. In the early 60s, the British government introduced surtax. Now, that meant if, after a certain income level, you earned a pound, you paid £1.20 tax. Well, all the millionaires were outraged and they left. And Ronald Garvey, our governor, said, we're not going to introduce surtax. So all the millionaires started coming here. This was accidental. No one had any idea of setting up a finance sector, but the millionaires brought with them their advocates and their accountants because they needed to know about Manx law. It was different. And gradually, this whole sector blossomed. And if you read this amazing book, No Man is an Island by Roger Rawcliffe, it's a history of the finance sector. It's hilarious because in those early years, it was the Wild West. It was completely unregulated. Anyone who could sign their name could get a banking license. That is no exaggeration. And this came to a head in 1982 because the chairman of the Savings and Investment Bank could sign his name, and he did it as a party trick by writing two cheques at the same time with his left and his right hand. Well, of course, the SIB went bust spectacularly. People lost millions of pounds. And this is the interesting thing. The chairman of Executive Council at the time was Edgar Mann. Now, Exco, as it was called, was the precursor to the Council of Ministers. There were no ministries, no Council of Ministers. There was the Health Board, the Highway Board, the Harbour Board. All the chairmen of these boards got together once a week, and they were the Executive Council. So when the bank crashed, Edgar, who was the chairman, effectively the Chief Minister, went across the road to the Isle of Man Bank to ask for a loan. Because at that time, the Isle of Man had only £1 million in reserve. We could only run the island for a few days if something like this happened. So the Isle of Man Bank, the chairman, kept him waiting in the corridor. Edgar told me this. I interviewed him about it. Kept him waiting in the corridor, had a meeting of the board, and came out and said, I'm sorry, Dr. Mann, but we've decided we're not going to give the government a loan because we don't think we should be underwriting failed banks. Now, if I was Edgar, I'd have said, right, I'm going to Barclays. And the irony of this was that, by tradition, the government's bankers, always had one of its directors on the Legislative Council. And the previous year, they'd voted against more banking regulation. So the point here is that we have dragged ourselves up from that period with £1 million in reserve to what we have today, which is, what, £1.6 billion in reserve? The Isle of Man is a success story. The infrastructure was broken in those days. Just look what we've done with new power stations, the Sulby Reservoir. We didn't need a reservoir for the current people in the late 70s, but there was a vision that we would need one for the future. And that was a massive civil engineering project. And our sewage systems and our water and all the things that we've done, it's incredible to where we are today. And we get up in the morning and we've got power. We've got hot water and, you know, our central heating comes on and all the rest of it. And all this has happened because of really inspired decisions by politicians, some of them visionary, and really good civil servants. And, you know, we have a lot to be grateful for. It's an incredible success story.
I love what you said there, though, Charles, a little earlier when you said actually a lot of these decisions were made perhaps in the 80s and you didn't necessarily realise that those decisions were ongoing. And that, I suppose, must give us an inherent sense of optimism that perhaps the same is happening today.
Well, I would hope so. I would hope so. Well, take tourism, for example. It failed, as again I say, nothing that was our fault. But as people stopped coming here, naturally there was no money to invest. People no longer wanted to stay in a boarding house like the Grasmere, which had one bathroom and one toilet on each floor.
Was that the one you were born in?
The one I was born in. And a chamber pot. OK. That was not acceptable anymore. So people wanted en suite, which was something you never saw advertised. What we were advertising in the 50s was hot and cold water in every bedroom. Really? That was quite exceptional, actually. Well, of course, all those hotels and the ones that have survived have had to merge two bedrooms into one or build little bathrooms in a bedroom. And if there was no money coming in, that just wasn't possible. So the Isle of Man has very cleverly, and is continuing to do it with some very exceptionally good people running it, to reposition its offering to people. And I was reading the other day that bookings to places like Spain and Italy and Greece in the height of the summer are dropping dramatically because people don't want to go to this blistering heat. And believe it or not, bookings to Norway have gone up 50% in the last 3 years. And I've often thought, with climate change, potential global warming, will the British seaside holiday see a revival? Now, not buckets and spades and naughty postcards, but an offering where the Island Man can compete easily with Ireland, Scotland and Wales. We have fabulous heritage, great vintage transport, wonderful walks and kayaking and diving and all the rest of it. And good restaurants, you know, plenty to do for a family. And this uniqueness of coming to an island is very, very important. It's just that feeling, as it was in Victorian times, you could go away. Come abroad to the Isle of Man, people said, because when you got here, you didn't have to eat foreign food. You could still spend English money, but you were somewhere different. And that is something, I think, which is very important.
And you know what, Charles? I think it's very hard to encapsulate everything that the Isle of Man has to offer. I mean, we often think this if we go out for a family walk somewhere and you see the views and just looking at the island sort of sitting in the sea. And it's like, I don't know how you sell that because it's so hard to put into pictures. I mean, a photograph doesn't do it justice. Words don't seem to do it justice. Yeah, how do you sell it?
Well, it's Instagram, isn't it? It's TikTok. It's constantly going at people with things that intrigue them and interest them. And, of course, getting the accommodation right, which we're doing, and the fair structure to get here, that's always been an issue, but it's been an issue for 100 years, so it's nothing new. It's just a constant advertising and thinking of innovative ways to get the message across. There was a time, even in the 70s and 80s, where they used to print 180,000 brochures every year and post them out. They did marketing and all sorts of things. They went to trade shows, and that worked. It doesn't work now. It has to be done through social media and all the rest of it.
I love what you said about intriguing people, because this brings me on to a series of videos that you did. It must be 20 or more so years ago now, the Curiosities of the Isle of Man. Absolutely love these, Charles. And for somebody like you who loves the island so much, delving into these things obviously brings you a lot of joy.
I was always looking for something, you know, a new video to make. And over my life, people were saying, oh, there were tunnels here, and somebody said there was this, somebody said there was that. And it suddenly, that light bulb moment, I thought, well, why don't I actually investigate these and see if they really exist? And to my astonishment, there are huge chambers under the streets of Douglas, like the one at the bottom of Crellin's Hill. I didn't believe it, but then I saw the plans, and then I got Douglas Corporation staff to lower me down there to look at this. And all those sort of things came together. It was an absolutely fascinating thing to do. And, of course, you could do it anywhere in the British Isles, because they're all quirky people and quirky things. That's what makes history so interesting. But the Isle of Man has more than its fair share of unusual things. And some of the clips have been put up online. The bank vault in Bridge House in Castletown, which sadly is not open to the public, but fortunately I got in to film it. That's had 1.4 million views online. I don't know who these people are. I've had people from California saying, gee, we want to build a replica of this. Can you send us the plans? Well, I'm sorry, I can't. I haven't got the plans. But people are intrigued by those things. And that is something we really should be majoring on, and maybe making all those things available. The Second World War stuff, the videos I've done on that have had hundreds of thousands of views. People are really interested in it, and it's just pulling that together and maybe making it as a package to visitors who come here.
And something else that you've been involved in, which is, I think, a great example of making an historic venue relevant for the modern day, is Milntown, which is just a glorious combination of history, quite a dark history, I think it's fair to say, in some aspects, but also a visitor attraction. I'm sure that was in one of your videos, wasn't it, before the refurbishment took place?
Yes, I did a thing on the ghosts. There were rumours. Well, we've all had experiences up there which we can't explain. I can't say they're ghosts because I don't know what a ghost is, but they're inexplicable things. So I did do a film of that in the Curiosities, and then the three trustees invited me in for a meeting one day, and I thought, well, they're going to ask my advice on a bit of history. And when I sat down, they said, would you like to join us on the board? This is about 20 years ago. So I said, yes. I didn't ask the question, well, how much do I get paid? No, I didn't. We get a very tiny remuneration, which hardly covers my petrol, but that's not the point, because, as you say, it's one of the most historic houses on the island, and Ilium Doane was born there, and the Christian family have lived there for hundreds of years. And we gradually developed it, opening the cafe and the gardens and everything, into, you know, a venue. It's an historic house, and it should be open to the public. We don't have any government money, which, it sounds strange to say this, I'm very pleased about, because, dare I say, if we did have funding from the government, we would be involved in focus groups and documents on how we're going to spend this. And, you know, the fact at Milntown, we just said, we want to do this, so we'll just do it. We get on with it. And that is a great pleasure. So, yes, that's been a very interesting project.
You're very well known also, Charles, for highlighting the things that perhaps aren't so good, that need sorting out. Let's use the railings on the Marine Drive as an example. I suppose some people might see this as you being quite critical.
Yes. The unfortunate thing is that with all the books I've published, the videos I've done, sadly, the one thing I'm known for now is getting some railings replaced. And I'm not saying it was me that did it. I think there is more to what's going on than that. I was inspired to do that first video, Welcome to the Isle of Man, by Daphne Kane, actually, who stood up in Tynwald, and we all agreed with her, saying, you know, the island looks a mess. We've got the visitor season coming. We're not fit for purpose. So I thought, well, she's right, because when I was a boy, the island was got ready in March and April. All the railings were painted. I remember a group of three or four men, I could hear it from our boarding house, tapping on all the beautiful railings on the prom. All the old paint was taken off. They were all painted green. And, you know, that was just one of 100 things that were done. The island was got ready. Only this year, when Daphne spoke, we know it wasn't ready. It looked dreadful. And I thought, I'll just pull all this together. And it got a massive response, because people also felt that we should at least be able to mow the grass and do basic things. And And for my sins, I'm now on the Destination Board Committee, who are desperately trying to get some of these things sorted. And it's a challenge. You would wonder how difficult it is to get some flower planters replaced. Or, and this is a real bugbear of mine, when you come into the airport and you're standing there waiting for your luggage in the baggage reclaim, why aren't the leaflets? Why aren't there no plastic dispensers with everybody's leaflets in it? I've been trying for 2 years to get that done. How difficult is that? You just can't get to speak to anyone who'll do it. Simple things like that, that surely. What I'd like is £100,000 and a small hit squad of expert people who just go and paint those railings, repair that wall, just get on with it. Anyway, that's my challenge at the moment.
And I suppose also there must be something in some of this being community driven and people as all taking responsibility for our island and how it looks. And, you know, following on from the railings along Marine Drive, actually there was a local company, Upmost, I'll give them a name check here. They had all of their employees down in various stints and Peel Promenade painting the railings, and what a difference it makes. And I think almost leading by example, there are lots of companies presumably that would like to do that sort of corporate responsibility sort of initiative, but it's just, I suppose, yeah, just getting us all to take a little bit more pride.
Well, that's very true. And that cosmetic alteration, the painting of the railings, the cleaning up, it just has a marvellous effect on you. You drive past someone, you think, oh, that rubbish is gone. It actually, just for that moment, raises your spirits. And it also says, we care about our environment and we're going to keep it tidy. It's not expensive. It's not hugely complicated. But dare I say it, we are coming up against some difficulties because I suppose health and safety, and you can't give hedge trimmers to untrained people and all the rest of it. I understand all that. It's just finding a way through all that and just, you know, getting on with the job. In the old days, you had trust in people and there was common sense. A lot of that, I'm afraid, is gone because it now has to have start of project forms filled in, end of project forms filled in, this, that and the other. And it's people covering their backsides, I'm sorry, and you really don't need to do that in a lot of these cases. You just need to go and do it.
But what we do still have are people who care very deeply about the island. Let's just think about Beach Buddies and Bill Dale and the team there, for example. And I think it's finding those people and their followers, of who there are many, many people
exactly.
who volunteer.
Yes.
And it's, you know, that's quite heartening, isn't it?
Well, Beach Buddies is obviously the shining example because Bill's done a brilliant job and they go and do the job and they just get on with it. Obviously, they've got their gloves on and their pincers and it's all properly organised, but they're let get on with it. And the difference they've made is extraordinary. It's that sort of group I would like to see expanded into other areas where they would make a huge difference. And it would take the stress off some of the civil servants. I mean, if you're in some of these departments and you're chief executive, I don't know how you go into work in the morning because the responsibilities you've got, and I'm thinking of the Department of Infrastructure, what a vast portfolio they've got. All the government buildings, from a leaky ceiling in Government House to the schools, the roads, the airport, the ports, the housing. How do you cope with that? I just don't know. I think it's a huge challenge. So when I come forward and say, well, could you paint these railings? I mean, they're going to say, excuse me, we've got other things to think about. So let us take that off you and we'll see to it.
And I'm going to say this with the caveat that obviously I'm married to somebody who is in the civil service, but this kind of goes back to something we were saying earlier about social media and the perception of people. And I think the civil service particularly has taken a very big bashing at every single level in recent years, and that will take its toll on the people who work within it. And I don't know what you can do to get the understanding over to the public that actually the vast majority of people who go to work within government every single day are doing so with the absolute best of intentions. Mm. And that's not the narrative necessarily that's playing out in the public.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the people I know in the civil servants, and I'm dealing with them, are absolutely first class and they're really devoted to doing their job properly. And you're right, they are getting, and the politicians are as well. I was speaking to one the other day and I said, how do you cope with this negativity? And he said to me, well, it is difficult. And my 16-year-old son is reading this. And you're thinking, this is just pathetic. I mean, we don't need to be. If those people who are hammering everything all the time, if they got off their backsides and joined this group and went and did something, it would make the place a lot better. And you're quite right. The majority of these people are really doing it because they want the job to be done properly. and we really need to recognise that.
Did you ever think about politics yourself, Charles?
No, I reported it, as I say, for very many years. I think to be an MHK, I'm far too old to start being an MHK now. You need to be young, you need to have had 10, 15 years in the real world, and then maybe start as a junior MHK, and I've seen a number of politicians do that. You move around departments, you might become a minister here, and then you move to being a minister there, and all the time you're gaining experience, you're gaining an understanding of how everything works, and then one day you may be chief minister. But it's because you've been minister in all the other departments, you know what's going on, and you know whether you're being bullshitted by somebody, and you know, no, that's not the way you do it. We're going to do it like this. So it's something you should go through. It should be a career thing. And it's never, for me, been attractive as a career.
You must have been asked, though.
Well, occasionally, but lots of people are asked, you know. In fact, you asked me when I first did that first video, am I going to stand for the House of Keys? And I felt, look, just because I've complained about the railings is my punishment that I've got to be an MHK. Everybody in there is just as competent and a lot more competent and better qualified than I am. They don't need me in there. There's enough of them in there to sort these problems. That's what we need, not me.
Let's go round again, though. Let's focus on the positives in terms of the island. Where would you say your favourite place is? Where should people definitely go and see?
I love the north of the island on a sunny day. The flat plain, looking south at those hills beyond Ramsey that all go around there, the sun just sparkles on them, and you've got the beaches. It amazes me, on a sunny day you can go to the beaches on the west of the island around Jerby, and there's 83,000 people on the Isle of Man, and there's one or two people on that beach. That's incredible. It's just fantastic, because I love monitoring the coastal erosion, and I'm often up there. And the valleys, I've got my electric mountain bike now, which has been an absolute revelation, because we've got wonderful tracks, really a wonderful network of tracks. You can go up the Snaefell Valley, you can go up the Corrony Valley, up to Park Llewellyn, up on these tracks, to remote places where the only sound are the birds. Just so special. It's actually elating being up there. Even on a winter's day, when it's bitterly cold, I still love going out with a flask of coffee and my sandwiches and sitting in a sheep hollow and just being up there. It's wonderful.
And as you say, very often you can go out and maybe only bump into a couple of other people. If this were the Lake District, you'd be surrounded by hordes of people.
Absolutely. You've seen the demonstrations in the last couple of days to stop tourists coming to some of the cities in Spain. We should be so lucky that we ever got to that sort of position. And I'm not saying, would we want to go back to the day where we had 670,000 people coming to the Isle of Man?
That's baffling.
Not over the year, but just over 8 weeks. And if you do the division, it meant that at any one time there were an extra 70,000 people on the Isle of Man. 250,000 meals were being produced every day. In the hydro, we were producing 520 meals a day. It was an industrial occupation, and walking down the prom, it was like being in Parliament Square in London. You had to push your way, that there were so many people. I don't think we want to go back to that necessarily, but we could, you know, move that way a little bit.
We can't talk to you, Charles, without referring back again, and I know you've talked a little bit about it, but the music, which is a huge part of the island as well, and something that obviously you're deeply passionate about. What makes the island so special in that regard?
Well, because we've got our own language. I mean, how extraordinary is it for a tiny island like this to have its own language? The Isle of Wight, I don't think, has that. Anglesey doesn't. This is extraordinary. We've got our own parliament, you know, for the Isle of Man. And may I just say, we've got our own symphony orchestra as well, our own national symphony orchestra. And those are the three things that make me think the Isle of Man is unique in the world. A parliament, a language and a symphony orchestra. And with that, our own culture, you know, our own legends, our own, as I say, language and our own music. All right, it is a branch of Scottish and Irish, but it's become very distinct in its own way. And an extraordinary history of weird people doing weird things for the last 1,000 years, with the monks and the Earls of Derby and the Dukes of Athol and the Vikings, all these people who've come here and left a stamp on us. It's absolutely fascinating. There are so many stories of peculiar things happening on the Isle of Man, and our culture has arisen from that. And our legends and our language and our music is uniquely Manx. It has definitely got a unique Manx flavour. And for a tiny island of just now over 80,000 people, there aren't many places in the world that have what we've got.
I love the idea that we're all just weird people doing weird things.
Yeah,
probably
well,
don't need to think about that too much, though. What's your favourite piece of Manx music?
Two or three of the Manx folk songs, certainly. The Sheep Under the Snow is very, very haunting. And Oren Gelby, which was a strange piece of music collected from Niabel with a legend of a man in a boat way out at sea. It's actually, I think, a variation of medieval plain chant. It's come down over hundreds of years, thousands of generations, and it's very, very haunting. Always reminds me of the Isle of Man.
And are they ones that you play yourself?
I have played them on the harp, yes, years ago.
What is it about the harp?
Well, I went to study music in London as an 18-year-old. I was immediately homesick, and while I was there, I was being lectured about English folk music. And I remember coming home at the first Christmas break thinking, I wonder if we've got any Manx folk music. Of course, I'd spent 9 years at King William's College, and that was utterly devoid of anything to do with the Isle of Man. We could have been in Kenya. We weren't taught anything about the Isle of Man. The Manx language was a joke because it didn't have any vowels in it, according to people there. We knew nothing about Manx culture. So I'd got to 18 and didn't realise we did have a rich history of folklore and music. So I thought, well, I'm going to learn these songs. And I tried the guitar, and I got a pain in my left arm. And I had friends in Ramsey, two old ladies, who had a harp. I thought, well, I'll learn the harp. So I went to Dublin for a day trip with my uncle, and we bought a harp. And that's how I got involved in it.
How amazing. Because it's not something that you naturally think about, I suppose, when you're starting to play an instrument. But there is something incredibly haunting about it, especially when it's playing the sort of songs that you were mentioning.
And there's a big Irish tradition, of course. And it was useful for accompanying my rather feeble singing. But I did sing Manx folk songs at the time.
Should I ask you to do one now?
No, you certainly won't.
All right. And I just want to wrap up, really, with something that you said just before about being away and being quite homesick, because this is a thing that always gets me. If you go around the world, there are societies all about the Isle of Man, Manx societies, and you've got America, Australia, London. And again, you said at the very beginning, for you, there was a real pull to come back. And I think that is true for anybody who's had an association here, even if it's an association perhaps by marrying into a family. There's a real fondness and affection for people when they don't actually live here.
Yes, I think that's true. I can't imagine what that feels like to actually be permanently living, if you were born here, off the island. Obviously, people can cope with it. I couldn't. I actually remember I was living in Dublin for 4 years. I was studying the harp with a very fine harp teacher there. And on the last return to Dublin, I was on the steam packet boat in floods of tears. I thought, I can't stand this anymore. So I decided that would be my last few months in Ireland. I applied for jobs on the Isle of Man. There was a job going as the manager of the Gaiety Theatre, which I applied for. And it was in the purview of the chairman of the Arts Council, Major Geoffrey Crellin. And apparently he said, well, what does Charles Gard know about managing theatres? Which was a very good question. And the answer was nothing. But then a job came up here at Manx Radio. And I started here in 1977 as head of religious programming, and the rest is history.
So then, can we call you a historian?
You can.
Charles Gard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Charles Gard, who I think is a very qualified historian when it comes to the Isle of Man. Lovely to talk to him and really insightful to hear his thoughts. And there is a real optimism after speaking to Charles about the fact that actually we might not see all the positive decisions that are being made at the moment, but perhaps they will be clearer as we move on. And you did hear two pieces of music there that Charles particularly loves when it comes to music from the Isle of Man. There was The Sheep Under the Snow, and actually Charles was on the harp there, and Bernard Osborne was on the violin, and also Aaron Gelby, the piece Charles mentioned that was collected at Niarbal and was supposedly sung by a strange man sitting in a boat out in the bay. Thank you so much for listening to the Isle of Man podcast, and if you'd like to share your thoughts about the Isle of Man and why you love it so much, then do get in touch. Beth Espy at manxradio.com. Until next time, take care. Bye bye.